Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Ryan, thank you. Visiting with Ryan, I find that he is also a geologist, and that's good. You don't run into many geologists nowadays as young as Ryan is. And I saw where Shell Oil Company was going to hire 1,000 geologists. And I think this was less than a year ago, and you may have seen that, Ryan. And I wondered if they were going to start calling me back into service, because I don't know where you'd get 1,000 geologists now. I'm not a long speaker, but I like to have questions, so if you would, and I'll hang around for all the questions you have. But I'm going to talk about the myth of energy independence, and I'm amused at the politicians when they start telling you what they're going to do for you, and they're in a campaign. Presidential politicians in particular, and I can go back before Carter in my recall, that they all tell you, if you elect me, I'll make our country energy independent. You go back over the years, 73 was when the Arab embargo was imposed, and at that time we were importing about 27% of our oil. By the time we got to the Gulf War in 91, we were importing 42% of our oil, and now we're importing over 60% of our oil. All the time, everybody that ran for president said, I'm going to make us energy independent, and we just keep importing more all the time. You'd think at some point that they would say, wonder if we can keep making this statement, that could we be energy independent? I don't think so. When we look back over the period that we all in this room will have lived, it will be identified at some time by researchers 400 or 500 years out, or 1,000 years out, or whatever, as a hydrocarbon era, because it started with the automobile in about 1900. At this point, that we're about halfway through all the reserves in the world. We've produced them. The other half will be produced, you'd think, by 2100. Not exactly, because we will have changed to other forms of energy by the time we get to 2100. But still, the hydrocarbon era will be viewed as about a 200-year period. And, you look at it certainly in geologic time, 200 years is nothing. But 200 years isn't that long either. And to think that hydrocarbons were used over that short period, and then we were to another fuel. when you look at the world today, the production is 85 million barrels of oil. You multiply 85 million times 365 days, and it comes out close to 30 billion barrels of oil that are produced every year in the world. We don't even come close to replacing that by the drilling and exploration that the industry does around the world. I'm talking about globally now. I'm not talking about the United States. The United States peaked on production in 1970 at 10 million 500,000 barrels a day. It's now 5.5. We're producing 5.5 million barrels a day. So we're about half of where we peaked 35 years ago. So all these fields are old fields, have either depleted or they're certainly in decline. And we're not finding oil around the world of the same magnitude we found in the past. So consequently, you're not replacing, And the 85 million barrels that's being produced today is about all the world can do. So you've seen some of the stuff on it that these peakers that are making these peaker speeches. Well, I'm not going to make a peaker speech, but I'm a peaker. I think we peaked. I think 85 million barrels is all we're ever going to be able to do. And so I says, well, you know, you got the Caspian Sea production coming on. I'm adding all that in, and I'm taking the decline of the existing production. But it's to give you a vivid example of decline is to look at Ghawar, the biggest field in Saudi Arabia. That field has produced about 55 billion barrels of oil. The field is produced, it was found in the late 40s, and in the late 50s they started to inject water into the field below the oil-water contact to maintain pressure. Good production practice. That now, that field has gone from a peak of about 5.8 million barrels down to about 4.3 million barrels. So it is in decline. Wonderful, wonderful oil field, of course. They're now injecting into the field 18 million barrels a day of water, seawater, in the field. So that is replacing what you've taken out from in the oil column, and they're just floating the oil right up and out. But know that field, the biggest field in Saudi Arabia, is in decline. When you see different ones, usually, once again, it seems like I'm picking on politicians today. I don't, not any reason for that, but the media, whoever they talk about, we're just, all we need is more refining capacity. They don't ever speak of supply, they speak of refining capacity. And back years ago when I made speeches in California, and they were going to switch over to the electric car. And maybe some of you remember that. In fact, they passed some stupid bill that said that by, I don't know, 1990 or something, you're going to have to be 10% of the vehicles in California will be on electricity. Well, that's stupid because you can't do that. It won't happen. They tried it. The battery was not powerful enough. It wouldn't stay up long enough. It had to be recharged. And if you turned on the radio and the windshield wipers, air conditioning, at the same time you had to park. And so it wouldn't work. And finally they scrubbed the idea. But when I talked after, I would ask people, you know, the electricity has to be generated from somewhere. And I would look at the audience and say, where do you think electricity comes from? And they'd all look at the wall socket. It was being generated, of course, over in Utah, Nevada, and shipped back to California, and the emissions went east because of prevailing west-to-east wind. Everybody understands all that now, and it's interesting to see, you know, now what the solution is going to be. And I'll get to that in a minute, but I want to tell you another story or two. I had a congressman come to see me about 2 months ago, and I thought it was a friendly call asking for money. That's what they usually come to see you about. But this was something different, and it was kind of nice to have him come for something different. But what it was is he didn't like what I was saying on television about gasoline prices, that you're getting ready to see $4 gasoline. And he said, and let me know, we can't stand that. And, you know, we can't, you know, and I looked around. I thought, is he talking to me? And I said, well, do you think I'm in the gasoline business? And he said, no, but he said, you're saying this, and it's running the price up. I said, no. I said, the fundamentals are the only thing that run the price up. I said, you might be able to talk them up or down for 3 minutes, but I said, not much longer than that. And I said, he said, well, I want you to know we will take action in Congress to cap the price of gasoline. And I said, really? I said, you need to look back on what happens when you start doing things like that. You creating bigger problems than you've already got. Well, he said, I just want you to know that there are a number of us, and we've talked about it. I'm sure. Okay. That's good. Glad you've talked about it. But the gasoline prices are going to go on up. And I asked him a question. I said, where would you like for gasoline prices to be? If I had the power to set the gasoline price, where would you like it? And he said, I'd like it under $2. I said, okay, well, that's good. I'm glad to know what you'd like to have. Under $2 will create so much demand for gasoline. You've got to kill the demand with the price. There's not any other way to do it. There's no other way to do it than to get the price up, kill the demand, make people realize what gasoline is really worth. And that's exactly where we are today. That's the way I think it'll unfold. Price will continue. It'll drop back every once in a while, and then it'll move on up again. But it's a upward trending curve. And somebody said, well, how high does it get before it kills demand? Probably doing some of it right now. You'll see demand maybe drop back here. But if you go back and look at rising prices on gasoline, seldom kill demand. They just slow it down. And here, I don't know whether it takes $5 gasoline. If it was up to me, I would say tax it up to $5, put it on a global basis so that our gasoline is the same price as the rest of the world, which it's not. And then oil is, but gasoline isn't. Go ahead and tax it up. Take some taxes off, payroll taxes or whatever. I'm not smart enough to talk about these subjects, you understand. But I am smart enough to know that the way you're going to get this under control is to raise the price. But go ahead and get it up so that we are in a global market. There's no question about that. But if we had $2 gasoline and Europe has $5 gasoline, I can tell you the arbitrage is so huge, the gasoline would go to Europe and not to here. And, you know, last winter, we had a warm winter, but we had a lot of heating oil go out of the United States to Europe. You know, and people say, my God, are we exporting now? Yeah, we export when the arbitrage is right. We'll take advantage of it. The people that have it, move it wherever they can go. It is a global market. Last winter, if we'd had a cold winter, we would have been in competition with the UK and Spain for LNG. Spain had no hydroelectric, and so they were in real need of LNG. The UK needed; they were cold, and we were warm, so we never got into the LNG market. We imported, I think, something less than 10% of what we normally do for winter LNG. If we had been in that market and had a cold winter, you'd have had $15 or $20 LNG is what it would have been. So the let me move on. I get too strung out on some of these. I'm getting to the age where sometimes I might ramble, and Pat's told me she'll raise her hand if I'm rambling. So, you see these congressional investigations. Now we're going to investigate ExxonMobil again. I was in Corpus Christi 2 weeks ago, and my wife was receiving an award for the dogs that she got out of New Orleans and took to California. Some of you may have seen that. And it was the SPCA gave her an award, and it was very, very nice lunch and many nice things said and people. I did find out on that Katrina disaster. I gave a nice gift to the Red Cross, and I got about this many emails, all nice emails. My wife moved 800 dogs to California, and her gift was one-tenth of what mine was, and she got this many emails. I thought that I learned something there, that people in America were a lot more interested in getting the dogs to California than they were some of the other things that were going on. But anyway, I got off the airplane and asked me if I would speak to the TV people there. I said, sure, I'll be glad to. What do they want to talk about? And they said, well, they want to talk about gasoline prices. People in Corpus Christi are really upset about this. I said, well, okay, I'll talk to them. They said, well, we got a city commissioner that this morning came out with had a press conference and wants to boycott the ExxonMobil stations in Corpus. And the guy looked at me, is he going to answer? You know, I hesitated. I said, I'm thinking. I'm ready. I've got an answer to that question. So what is it? I said, that's the dumbest question I've heard this month. He said, you know you're on television. I said, I hope so. But insane stuff. ExxonMobil produces 2.5 million barrels a day. Go back to the 85 million. That's 3%. 3% of the oil in the world is price gouging. And they're going to have another hearing in Washington to get these guys back in. They haven't passed a bill. Help me if I'm wrong. They haven't passed a bill, but it was proposed that if caught price gouging, it's a felony. Can you imagine how you would figure out if somebody was price gouging? I mean, how the proof of price gouging for Lee Raymond, who's now retired, and Rex Tillerson, who's taking his place, at ExxonMobil. Those guys don't have time to talk about the gasoline price, and I don't think they spend 3 minutes a month talking about it. The market decides what the price is, not the company. But anyway, we're going to have more investigations, so that'll be interesting to see all that. And the media will be positive, very positive in their thoughts about it. It is price gouging. I mean, you know, how they interpret everything for us, that of course that must be going on because the price has gone up, and then they'll give you a curve of it going up, and that immediately tells you if the price is going up like that, you're being gouged, whether it has anything to do with the market or not. But the one last question, and then to it says get serious about alternatives. We're going to have alternatives. There's no question that we are. And somebody said the other day, say, well, what about biodiesel? Do you think that'll solve the problem for us? Biodiesel solve the problem? You know, they talk about some of that's grease out of restaurants. I've seen restaurants I thought were greasy enough to fix a problem, but, you know, that's nothing. I mean, sure, biodiesel will work. There's no question. All these things will work. But how many, you know, are we going to have? You're going to have probably most of them are going to get a chance. I'm not so sure how much switchgrass we're going to be able to raise to solve the problem. You remember that was one idea that somebody came up with. But all of them will work. All of them will work. And the ethanol situation is some of the companies some of the ethanol companies that are coming out, I'm not opposed to it to start with, so you don't try to read it. He doesn't like ethanol. I like everything because I think you're going to need everything. Those that will be the cheapest will be the ones that will be used first, and then as time passes, all of them get very expensive, and so we'll probably use all of them. But ethanol raised from corn is not going to solve our problem for energy in this country. And we use about 20 million barrels of oil a day in this country. If you had a cornfield from the Mississippi to California, solid cornfield, and it was a good crop, and you turned it all into ethanol, it would be less than 5% of the gasoline needed in this country. I mean, it's not a serious replacement for gasoline, but it will be used. Now, probably you're better off to use sugarcane than you are corn, and we subsidize corn 54 cents a gallon you subsidize corn that is used for ethanol. And we had a 51 cent tariff on ethanol coming in to the country, and the president said this morning that he wanted to see that taken off, and I hope so. I don't know. You know, you got a pretty strong lobby when you can get a 54 cent subsidy and then get a 51 cent tariff to go along with it. And so ethanol will be an interesting story as it unfolds. Last point, natural gas. I'm in this business, so you know that now, for the first thing I've said up to this point, I have a conflict probably. But natural gas will be used as a transportation fuel more and more. and DART here uses natural gas. And we sell a lot of LNG to DART. There's a station at Love Field, and there's a big station at DFW. It burns 90% cleaner than gasoline. It's a domestic fuel, and it's cheaper. I started that pitch in 1988 and believed I'd sell it in 3 years. Now, here it is 2006, and I finally made it. So you can see, if you think my timing's good, it's oftentimes really not good, even bad. But we have a business in California, but we're clear across the country, and we have LNG and CNG, compressed natural gas, at 11 airports around the United States. And if you look at Love Field from above, where I used to be in Trammell Crow Center, very, very bad air quality. You can see it from above it. And what's going to happen is you're going to see natural gas and electricity used for vehicles on the ground at airports. Can't do anything about the planes much, but they'll take the gasoline and diesel away from the airport locations. Having said that, we have 170 stations in the United States, 100 of them in California, and those stations, what will take place, I think, on transportation fuel is that natural gas will become more and more a transportation fuel and a second infrastructure to gasoline and diesel. Probably not for your car, but for fleets and all, it fits very well. And where does the gas come from? It'll come off of power generation. Power generation of the 100%, 50% of power generation comes from coal, about 25% from nuke, and 20% from natural gas and 5% from other. So the 20% for natural gas is the most expensive power generation that we have. So it's a natural to be moved out of that sector and it be filled by nuclear and coal. And that'll happen when? The next 10 years or so. All of this is going to be slow to move, but you're going to see so much about it to the point where you're going to there's got to be something better. To me, sad situation in Aruba, but I tell you what, I've seen all that I want to see on TV. Every time I turn on TV, they've got that sad story about the little girl that was lost down there, but they just keep on. You're going to see more about energy, more about ethanol than you want to see in the next 2, 3, 4 years. But it's going to take a long time to get to where we want to be as far as energy is concerned. And don't believe any of these guys that get up and tell you, we are going to be energy independent while I am in office. That is absolutely a myth. Thank you. Questions? Yeah, the question is, do we have lignite and coal in Texas? Where does it fall in the pecking order and all? Everything, again, is going to be used. And we're using lignite and we're using coal in Texas. I saw, and I'm not an expert on lignite and coal, but I'll tell you what I know, that you saw where TXU is going to build 10 coal-fired plants in Texas over, I think, the next 5 years, spending $10 billion to do that. And I think that's a good preview of what's going to happen in this country. I think they're a little ahead of the crowd, but that's where it's going. Coal-fired plants, lignite will be a fuel that will be used too. But, yes, we do have a lot in Texas. Uranium, I'll answer first. I don't know anything about uranium. And on coal, when do we peak? I think we have a 250-year supply is what I saw recently, which I thought was probably as accurate as you could get. There's no question you can take, you can go coal to gas, you can go coal to liquids, you can convert it to hydrocarbon, you can take it to liquids or you can take it to gas, either one, and it all depends on the price. That's it. If it's an economic project, and I've looked at a gas to liquids, a coal to liquids deal 2 or 3 weeks ago. It looked like it was a you know, it made sense. In talking to the guys around the table, my key guys, when the presenter left, I said, fellas, let me tell you, every one of these deals are going to work, but because of my age, we've got to figure out which ones work the quickest. Now, Pat, I've got to correct you. I retired from Mesa in the mid-90s. The 96, I left Mesa, and I was 68 years old, and I started. You know, we go back to we were talking, but Pat was with Goldman, and that was in the 80s, yeah, early 80s. That's right, 1980. You said you were top producer for Goldman in that year, and you called on us, and I remember the first time you called on us. You threatened me and said you may not call on us again because it took you 2 days to get to Amarillo. And so we moved to Dallas. But let's see, back to the point. I left in 96. I left Mesa in 96 and started our commodity fund in 97. We had really had an unusual record, and we had a business, and I didn't recognize it. We, in 1986, we got into crude oil market futures, and from 86 to 96, we went in that with 2 million equity, and over that period, 86 to 96, we did not ever have a losing year for 10 solid years. Well, that's better than, you know, that's a trend. It's better than a trend when you go 10 straight years. I should have known we had the personnel, we knew the business well enough, and we could make money in that business. But we never developed it. We almost apologized for it at Mesa as, well, you know, it's, you know, yes, we made some money out of that. But we should have just come forth and said, yes, we're making money out of this, and it's a good business to make money in. Well, anyway, in 96 when I left, I got five of my friends, and we started off with $34 million. And believe it or not, 1997 was our first year, and it was my first loss in 11 years. Hey, like that. You know, I mean, it's really riding up in front of the grandstand and falling off your horse. I mean, and 98, same thing, loser. It was a loser. I thought, God, I can't believe this. We went 10 straight years and two straight losses. Then we haven't lost since. So now we've gone 20 years from 86 to 06, and we have two lost years, 97 and 98. I think the Lord was testing me just to see if I'd stay in there and keep grinding. But you need to see what a loss is like for a while, pal. And so we saw what it was like. But that business has done extremely well, and from that initial $34 million, that business has made over $2.5 billion. And then in 2001 we started our equity fund, and that business now is 7 years old. We've had one losing year out of the 7 years, and we're up 800% on that. So you asked me what I've done, and then this April when I signed my check to the government, which I consider paying taxes a high class problem, and so my accountant said, you've had impeccable records, and he said, I've looked at them all, and he said, when you sign that check, you will have paid 90% of all the taxes you've paid in your career after you were 70 years old. I kind of like that, and I don't, at 78, that, you know, it's not bragging, I don't think. I mean, it's just kind of, I'm proud of it. I like to work, I like to make money, and I don't mind paying taxes, and so it's been an unusual part of my career, and thank you for asking the question. But from 96, the 90s weren't too good to me, and a bad decade. But then, you know, everything kind of turned around, and it was real great. Yes. Oh, the price of oil? That's the question? How high will it go? Well, tell me. I think I've got it. How high will the price of oil go? Okay, give me the circumstances that I have to work with. I mean, if you tell, well, I think they're going to have to take a rant. How many in this room believe that either the United States or Israel will attack Iran in the next 3 years? Raise your hand. Me too. I think that is what's going to happen. And if that happens, you know, you could go to $100 oil real quick. Somebody said, yeah, you go real quick. You release the SPR, of course, and to try to settle the market down. But if they do, if they destroy any of the Iranian production capacity, then SPR is only a temporary fix. And so I think if you don't have anything happen, that the 85 million barrels, if you buy that prediction I made, if the 85 million barrels is all you have, it's going to be hard to hold 85, because once you go in decline on these big fields, well, it's hard to replace to the point where you can cover the decline. So let's just say you do hold the decline. I mean, you hold the 85. And then you've got China. The China is coming up like they are. See, China has doubled, I think, in 10 years to where they're up to about 6.8 million barrels a day. They were 3.4 10 years ago. And they import half of their oil. And so they're not going to find a lot of oil in China to cover their demand internally. So their demand coming up, that, and, you know, around the world, including the United States, demand is still going up, that you're, well, right now we're using about 84 to 84.5 million barrels a day. So we're right on the 85. And that's why the price keeps creeping up. In the fourth quarter of this year, I think projections, and I'm a parrot here because I don't do these calculations, is about 86 million barrels a day. Whoops, that's more than we're going to produce. Well, there's a lot of oil in storage, and in first quarter, usually, well, demand goes off some, but you just keep getting more and more demand. So where's the price of oil going to go? I'd say that, you know, that... I've been good on these predictions too. I'm not near as, I never was cocky. Know that. I never was cocky. But I was pretty sure of myself. But now I'm getting a little, you know, I think, yeah, I've booked a few wins here and I don't want to stub my toe. But at $75 a barrel, we call that one. Call it 75. We've dropped back to 69, but it's going to go. It'll come right on back up. I don't know where you really seriously slow demand down to the point where you can hold it. But I would say a year from now you're looking at $80 oil. Water. The water. You know, there is so much water up in the Texas Panhandle. Seriously. That's right. I was not trying to be funny. But there is. And it's water that's actually, it's stranded water, and it's surplus water. I'm talking about, look at the four northeast counties up there. That's the furthest up is Lipscomb, Ochiltree, Roberts, and Hemphill. I'm located in Roberts. Those counties are full. The Ogallala is full because there's only about 3% irrigation in those four counties because it's rolling hills. Believe it or not, we have rolling hills up there in that area. I know you go up through Amarillo to Aspen if you drive, or you go from Oklahoma City to Albuquerque, and it's flatter than, you know, that's not a very good description. It wouldn't be appropriate to make that. But anyway, it's in the rolling hills up there. Consequently, you can't irrigate, so there's a lot of water in those four counties. And our project that we have is 200,000 acre-feet of water a year is what we were offering, and we got no takers, so we raised it, and now we're offering 320,000 acre-feet of water a year. Somebody said, I don't get it, that you didn't get any takers at 200. Why would you get takers at 320,000? It's up 50% from what it was when you first offered it. Well, the bigger the volume, the lower the price is what it is. So we can deliver 320,000 acre-feet of water. Give you a quick reference point. The Metroplex, Fort Worth and Dallas both, use 1.4 million acre-feet of water a year. So you're talking about 300,000 acre feet of water a year. So you're talking about what is that, 15% of the, would that be right? Pretty close. 12%. Anyway, of the total. So it's not a, it's a amount of water that would come into this area that would bridge this area to, on to, Dallas doesn't need water, but North Texas Municipal does. Tarrant Regional will in 5 years. And so it's water that's going to be needed. And, let me just think with me for a second. And another reference point, out of the upper 21 counties in the Texas Panhandle, they use 1.8 million acre feet of water a year. So they use more water in those upper 21 counties for irrigation than we use in the Metroplex municipalities. So if you take the rest of West Texas, and that's in the Ogallala, which has been on production for over 50 years, it's the biggest aquifer in North America. Well, what's happened is, as the price for natural gas, then that's what they use for their power to lift the water, pump the water up. The price of natural gas is coming up to the point that you really can't irrigate to raise corn because the price of lifting is greater than the profit on the corn. So what you're going to see out there is more and more of West Texas going to dryland farming as it was at one time. And there's a lot of dryland farming out there now, and you make a crop about every 4 years, but that you can make it that way. In wheat, if you make a good crop in 4 years, you're doing pretty good. The point of this is all of that water is going to be available for municipal use in the rest of Texas. How much is that water? It's 5.8 million acre feet of water a year, 5.8. It's just maybe a coincidence, but the 50-year need for the state of Texas is 6 billion acre feet of additional water in Texas to take care of our projection. So that water will eventually, and it'll be great for the landowners out there because you put a grid in to West Texas, let them sell water, let them irrigate, either one, whatever they want to do. And they can sell water if they want to, irrigate if they want to. So, yes, Norman. The oil sands up in northern Alberta, I lived in Calgary in 67 when they announced that project, the first project up there. And the smart guys, I was included in that, the smart guys, we were over at the Calgary Petroleum Club and said, this won't ever work because you'd have to have at least $5 oil to make it work. And now we've got $75 oil. But the oil sands does work. It is expensive. And actually, I love the project because I don't have to deal with the decline curve. And it is the largest single investment I have is in the Canadian oil sands. It's in Suncor and the Canadian oil sands, the Canadian Oil Trust, in those two public companies. But when you put 1 million barrels a day on in the oil sands, the cost to put it on has now very quickly gone from 2 years ago, $40 billion, to now $70 billion. So Norman said, why don't we put more of it on? That we now have grown Fort McMurray to about 150,000 people, and when Norman and I lived in Calgary, it was about 1,500 people. I'm not sure there are enough welders and truck drivers. Norman, to answer your question, I don't know what you would do up there if the production at this point is 1,100,000 barrels a day. Suncor's producing 270,000 barrels, and the Syncrude project is a little bit larger than that. And the additions to what they have and have already been financed will take it up to about 2 million barrels a day by 2012. But to add it, you could add... let's compare it to Saudi Arabia right quick. Saudi Arabia claims to have 250 billion barrels of oil. I don't believe that, but let's accept it as okay number. That's about what the oil sands, the Canadian oil sands report, is about 250 billion barrels too. Saudi Arabia produces, last year, was 9.1 million barrels of oil a day. Canadian oil sands is 1.1 right now. So it's 1/9 of what with the same amount of reserves. But the infrastructure is very expensive, and it's very difficult to put it online. But theoretically, you could take the oil sands up to 8 or 10 million barrels a day. That's got to be somewhere over $1 trillion, but it would be expensive. But what an asset for the United States. I mean, I was on 60 Minutes the other day, and I said that, you know, this was great. I said, I don't think people in the United States realize how important this is to us, because we're really the market for that oil. I mean, we are the one that the oil's going to go to here. It is great. The Shell guy came on right after I did, and I said 250 billion barrels, and the Shell guy said 2 to 3 trillion is what the barrels. But he did say in place, and I said recoverable. So I don't know. I haven't had a chance to check to see whether I think I'm right. I think he is too. I think there must be 3 trillion barrels in place. But the further it goes, the technology gets better and better, and the technology getting better gets better recoveries at a cheaper price. And so it's now in the oil sands, anything that's over $20 a barrel is profitable. It takes them about $20 a barrel. And Ryan started shuffling his feet, and Pat did like this. And so one more question. The three companies? Three or four? Suncor would have to be high on the list. And, you know, I'd pick a coal company. I'd put coal in the deal. I'd put Peabody in it. And I'm trying to get out. Canadian Oil Sands would be one, but that's very similar to Suncor. And I could give Arch Coal would be one that I think's well run and has plenty of coal reserves. I like companies that have a lot of reserves. I don't like to deal with declines. And I don't know. Those four in energy, I think would probably you'd be happy with your investment. I've enjoyed being here. I've appreciated your questions. I always feel like I get more out of these kind of meetings than you all do, because I like to know what you're thinking. I like the count on, I think I'm right on what's going to happen in Iran. And Jim says, let's go.
Thank you very much, sir. Pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.